But if you remember from 2 weeks ago, in going through Genesis 18 and 19, it was dealing with Sodom and Gomorrah, and also with Lot. Lot, a very strange man to analyze. It's tough to nail him down. On one section, you have him called in the New Testament a righteous man, and how he was vexed every day with what was going on around him. But as we look through it, we recognize that his righteousness was definitely imputed because of, I would say, Abraham's sake, because he did just about everything wrong you can do. Which on one hand is comforting, because it's good to know that you can mess up badly and the Lord is still gracious. But the consequences, the catchphrase that I used last time, and I think I stole it from Alan Redpath, and Lord knows who he stole it from, was saved man, wasted life. Because he had absolutely no impact on the town that he lived in. He had his son-in-laws laughed at him when he told them about impending judgment. His wife was still so stuck in Sodom that she looked back and lingered behind and was caught up in the destruction. And then his two daughters, while they did escape with him, were so messed up that they got their dad drunk and seduced him so that they could have kids with him. So not really a role model that we're holding out there. Sometimes it's good to learn lessons from other people's mistakes. I'd say that was one definite case where you want to look at Lot and say, well, what happened? When did you start turning your eye towards Sodom? When did you start getting more in love with the things of the world that are not of God instead of the things of God? So we come to chapter 20, and it says, Abraham journeyed thence toward the south country. I don't know, did he not want to sit there and look at the ruins? I mean, can you imagine living next to Ground Zero in New York City and nobody's going to fix it? Because that's what it was, because Sodom and Gomorrah had been completely destroyed. Whatever the case, he decided to move. He heads south toward the south country. And it says he dwelled between Kadesh and Shur and journeyed and sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah his wife, she's my sister. And Abimelech, the king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Now, if this sounds oddly familiar, it should, because back in chapter 12, we had the first iterance, the first time this happened, back in Egypt. It's 25 years earlier. Abraham and Sarah go down to Egypt, and he's afraid. He's afraid that they're going to see how hot-looking his wife is, and they're going to kill him to get his wife, because they were very upright people in that day. They wouldn't commit adultery, but they'd have no problem murdering you and taking your wife, as long as she was free and clear. A widow, that's no problem, even if they had to kill you to make her one. Now, he was reproved for that, and the Lord protected him, and nothing happened between his wife and Pharaoh back then. 25 years later, you'd think you'd learn that, right? He is a man of faith. We read about him in Hebrews, a great man of faith, how he's a friend of God, and by faith Abraham did this, and faith Abraham did that. I'm kind of wondering, at what point does old age kick to the point where you don't sin anymore? Any of you guys hit that yet? Because I was thinking by 40 for sure. You know, all of those youthful passions would just be gone and there'd be no more problems, but not so. Well, Abraham's 100 at this point. Sarah's 90. Now, you got to be wondering what's going on with Sarah, because I don't know of too many 100-year-olds who are worried about people scamming on their 90-year-old wife, you know. But then again, you have to also understand that she's about to get pregnant and have a baby here, right? Because the Lord was doing something. He'd made a promise. There's a rejuvenation that happens with Sarah and with Abraham, because we were told before that Abraham was as good as dead, that everything was dried up, nothing was happening for either of them. She's going to get pregnant and have a baby. He's 100 years old. He's going to remarry and live to be, what, 100, at 160 and have another 6 or 7 kids. So something happens here. In fact, in the next chapter, she's going to be nursing a baby at 100. So it wasn't just the ability to conceive. Is she starting to look a little younger again? You know, is it like some heavenly Botox going on? I don't know. But she's hot enough that Abraham's saying, we got to play the you're my sister routine again. Not his best move. Abimelech, now you'll read a bunch of Abimelechs in the scripture. Abimelech is a title. It's not a name, because otherwise you'll get real confused and think that Abimelech dude has been around a long time. But actually, it's like Pharaoh. There's multiple Pharaohs. Well, there's multiple Abimelechs in this area. And he takes Sarah into his harem. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, you're a dead man." Now, I like dreams like that. God shows up in your dream and says, "Dude, you're done. You're a dead man. For the woman which you've taken, she's a man's wife." On some aspect, I like that, because that's my dad, right? God's my dad, and he's intervening. Even though Abraham is being stupid and Sarah is going along with Abraham's plan, God is intervening and stopping anything from happening and telling Abimelech, "You've had it." Apparently, God says she's another man's wife. Apparently, God has a real problem with adultery. In Hebrews chapter 4, verse 13, it says, "Neither is there any creature which isn't manifest in his sight. Behold, all things are naked and open unto the eyes of him with whom we have to do." God knew. Abimelech didn't even know, but God knew. And, you know, if you are in some type of sin and you're thinking nobody knows, well, you're wrong, because there is somebody who knows, and it's a big deal to him. But Abimelech had not come near her, and we'll talk about that in just a second. He said, "Lord, will you also slay a righteous nation? Said he not unto me, 'She's my sister'?" And she herself said, "He's my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocency of my hands have I done this." I didn't know, God. I didn't know. And God said to him in a dream, "Yea, I know that you did this thing in the integrity of your heart, for I also withheld thee from sinning against me. Therefore, I suffered thee not to touch her." God said, "Yeah, I know. I know you didn't know, and I know you were innocent in this thing, and that's why I made it so that you couldn't, or you didn't." Couldn't, didn't is a question, and I begin, at the end of the chapter, I tend to think it was a couldn't. I think God did something supernaturally bad to the entire nation when she was there, so there wasn't anything going on in anybody's place. Interesting, he had purposed to do what was right, even as a pagan who didn't know God. And God said, "Yeah, I know, I honored that, so that's why I kept you from falling." Because think about what the stakes are, all right? God has already made a promise to Sarah, "You're going to have a child. Through your child, Abraham's son, all the nations of the world are going to be blessed." What happens if she gets in a relationship with this other guy? There's going to be confusion and there's going to be a question for all eternity about whether the offspring really is from Abraham in the first place. After all, he was 100 years old, you know. So God needed to step in supernaturally and say, "No, this is not going to happen." And this is what he says to him in verse 7. "Now therefore, restore the man his wife, for he's a prophet." Okay. Abraham, in case you didn't realize it here, he's being stupid at the moment, right? This is a stupid moment for Abraham. This is not a spiritual man of God walking by faith. This is man doing his own thing, going outside, not trusting God. I would think, if I was God, I'd be saying, "Abe, yeah, I guess he's one of mine. I mean, yeah, don't mention it. Don't spread it around." But no, no. God steps up when Abraham is still blowing it and says, "No, this dude is a prophet. This is my prophet." He's, because a prophet is what? Somebody who speaks forth for God. He's actually saying, "This guy speaks for me. He is my mouthpiece right now." He says, "He's a prophet, and he'll pray for you, and you shall live. And if you restore her not, know thou that thou shalt surely die, thou and all that are thine." Abimelech, just so you know, he's a prophet. He's my guy. He's going to pray for you. If he does pray for you, I'll forgive you and you'll live. But if he doesn't, you're toast. So, you know, you can think about what you want to do for the rest of the night. And no, Abimelech rose early in the morning. In fact, I bet his morning started as soon as that dream ended. He rose early in the morning and he called all his servants and he told all these things in their ears, and the men were sore afraid. Because I think, again, this had slopped over and had affected the nation. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said unto him, "What have you done unto us? And what have I offended you that you've brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? Thou hast done deeds unto me that ought not to be done." Have you ever experienced this as a believer? It's a humiliating thing when, as a believer, you blow it and somebody who doesn't even know God has to tell you and say, "Dude, aren't you a Christian? what are you doing here? You shouldn't be here. I mean, we do this stuff, but you, I thought you didn't do this anymore. That's kind of humiliating, really. That's where he's at. This is the pagan king rebuking Abraham for not trusting in the God that the pagan king didn't know until his dream last night. Abimelech said unto Abraham, what sawest thou that you've done this thing? What were you seeing that made you act this way? Obviously, it wasn't the promise of your God. Well, the answer is, verse 11, Abraham said, because I thought, well, there you go, there's your problem. Don't think, okay? Listen to God, trust God. Don't be thinking on your own, because look what he said. Surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. He's saying, well, yeah, but I started thinking about how wicked you guys were, and I was afraid you'd kill me and God couldn't protect me, because I know how bad you are. That's part of his excuse. And then he comes up, yet indeed, she is my sister. I mean, she's the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. She's my half-sister. So you see, I wasn't really lying when I said she was my sister. I was just sort of really a loophole. It kind of depends on... No, he was trying to deceive. You guys know how that works? I was rather good at that, which is a bad thing. I'm not saying that braggingly. I remember when I went off to college and... was away from my parents, which had been the restraining factor in my life, because I was lost. I just thought I was, but I wasn't. As my pastor Ken says, there's three types of people: them that is, them that ain't, and you got to do it with your weird finger, them that thinks they is but ain't. I was that category, thought I was but ain't, weren't. And I went off to college and started doing stuff, and my sister, who had since repented and started to get her life together at that point, was all concerned what she saw her baby brother doing. And one of the things that I had picked up down in college was I started to smoke. And I remember her saying, I come home one time and she got up her courage to confront me, you know, Steve, are you smoking? And I said to her, oh yeah, Sandra, every day. What was the truth? I was, actually. But my intention was to give her the impression that I wasn't, because then I could be justified. Well, I told you the truth, actually. But actually, I was trying to deceive. That's what Abraham is doing here. He's giving the impression that, well, I really wasn't lying. She is my half-sister. No, you were lying. And then he says, and it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house. God caused me to wander from my... You know, this word that's translated wander, there's a few different words in the Hebrew he could have used for wander. This particular one's used about 50 times in the Old Testament, and it's always bad. It's like when somebody is staggering drunk, that's wander. When someone is running off into sin, it's that same word. It's like he's saying God... He's almost... It's a lot like what Adam did in the garden to God. You know, it's the woman you gave me. It's her fault. You gave her to me. He's almost half blaming God here. He says, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said unto her, this is thy kindness which you shall show unto me. At every place whither we shall come, say of me, he's my brother. They'd set this arrangement up years ago, and everywhere they went, and who knows how many other times we're not told of, they played the she's my sister, and they lied to people and in hopes of protecting Abraham's skin. Well, Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants, and he gave them to Abraham, and he restored unto him Sarah his wife. And Abimelech said, behold, my land is before you, dwell where it pleases you. And unto Sarah he said, behold, I think this is with sarcasm, I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, he's to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee and with all others, and thus she was reproved. He says, yeah, your brother there, I gave him a bunch of silver and a bunch of stuff, and I said he can go anywhere. Now, this could say that he was correcting her as well, or reproved could also, that same word could be translated, shown to be right, that Sarah was right and that she was submitting to Abraham even though he was being stupid. You can look at it either way. But it says, Abraham, verse 17, prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bare children. For the Lord had fast closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Something had happened that had interfered with the normal reproductive cycle that was happening in the city. nobody was conceiving. It said he healed Abimelech as well. I think God made doubly sure that Abimelech was not going to be in a position to do any messing with a married man's wife. So I don't know what it was, but when Abraham prayed, God lifted that curse off of them, and they started having kids again, and everybody was happy. Now, chapter 21. It says, "And the Lord visited Sarah, as he'd said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he'd spoken." This is the fulfillment of the promise that started at least 25 years earlier. And those are not words that I like to have in sentences that concern me. Promises, 25 years. I don't like those. I like promise made, fulfilled that same afternoon. Those kind of sentences I like. But she'd had some promises. Abraham had some promises. And they had even tried to be God's little helper, you remember, with Ishmael, to solve their own promises. But it says God did as he'd said he'd do. He did it as he had spoken. Because that's how God is. If you don't understand that, and it's sometimes we're shocked by that. And we're not the only ones. Again, I can look at men and women in the Bible, and sometimes I can get the mistaken impression that they're somehow these super spiritual, up on a platform, high and holy, and I could never be like them. Until I read about Abraham acting stupid, and then I can say, well, I could be like that. He's not the only one. One of my favorite instances is in Jeremiah 32. Jeremiah said, "The word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Behold, Hanameel, the son of Shallum, your uncle, shall come unto thee, saying, Buy of my field, which is Anathoth, for the right of redemption is yours to buy it." Because they were getting ready to get carried into captivity. Jeremiah had been preaching, the Lord's going to judge us, we're going to get carried away. And God says, hey, your nephew's coming, and he's going to offer to sell you a piece of property. Now, if you know that you're going to get hauled away into captivity, buying property is a bad investment because you won't own the land anymore. But God says to him, he's going to come, and I want you to buy it, because it's going to be a sign to everybody else that this judgment's temporary, that you're going to come back, right? Well, that's what the Lord said to Jeremiah. And then in verse 8 in Jeremiah 32, it says, "So Hanameel, my uncle's son, came to me in the court of the prison, according to the word of the Lord, and he said unto me, Buy my field, I pray thee, that's in Anathoth, which is in the country of Benjamin, for the right of inheritance is yours, and the redemption is yours. Buy it for yourself." And then Jeremiah says, "Then I knew this was the word of the Lord." Now, he's a prophet, right? God's mouthpiece. And he says, God told me this, and it was almost like he's saying, I think. But then it happened, and then it was like, oh, yeah, that really was you, God. See, and that's how he is with me a lot of times. Like, did you really tell us to do that? And then you step out in faith, and then supernaturally, all of a sudden, the door opens up or the door shuts or whatever, and it's like, oh, that really was you. If that's you, if you've experienced that, that doesn't mean you're weak in the faith. It means you're prophet material, right? I guess. We certainly know that this fulfillment of promise here for Abraham and Sarah is not because of perfect obedience, because we just read chapter 20 where he was being a knucklehead. So if you think that the standard of God is perfect performance on your part, it's not. The call is to be holy because he is holy, but God calls us to be faithful, but he's also extremely graceful. It says he fulfilled it as he'd spoken. In verse 2, "For Sarah conceived, and she bare Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. She has a child. And Abraham called the name of his son that was born unto him, whom Sarah bare to him, Isaac," Itzhak. "And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac, being 8 days old, as God had commanded him." We're seeing some obedience now. "And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him." Can you imagine being 100 years old with a little baby running around? We had some friends over yesterday. We met them in Lamaze class with my oldest daughter. You know, she's going to be 16 this year, so it's been about 16 years. They have a couple older daughters. And then they just had a boy who's like a year old. So he was up running into everything. You know, my wife was having to blockade all the stuff off because he wanted to push every button and he wanted to grab every cord and he wanted to get into everything. And I was tired just watching him, you know. And I'm only 42, 43. I can't imagine being 100 years old with a toddler. Can you imagine chasing a toddler at 100? Can you imagine, ladies, nursing a baby every couple hours through the night when you're 90? Abraham, you get him. I can't get out of bed. You get him. I mean, that's why Sarah said, God's made me to laugh. So that's all that will hear will laugh with me. His name, Itzhak, means laughter. They named the kid Laughter. Now, Sarah's saying, it's so funny that we would have kids in our old age. But that's not the only reason why he's named Laughter. He's named Laughter because when God showed up a year ago and said, you're going to have a child, Sarah didn't believe and she laughed. She thought it was so crazy that they could have one, knowing how old she was and knowing where Abraham was. But now it's just got to be joy in that house. It's got to be amazing. And she said in verse 7, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah should have given children suck? That's King James for nursed. For I have borne him a son of his old age. There's no making formula for this woman. She has been rejuvenated to the point at 90 years old that she can nurse a baby. And the child grew and was weaned. Probably in that culture somewhere around 3 years old. There's a lot of varying opinions about when is the right time for that. You know, some cultures, they'll nurse until 6, 7 years old. It's just wrong, in my opinion. And I understand, God bless them, but my rule of thumb is if they can ask for it, they don't need it, okay? They can speak the words, they can find the fridge. That's what I'm thinking. But anyway, a little extra bonus there for you. The child grew, was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking Ishmael. Because you remember 14, 15 years earlier, Sarah had this promise from God, but she realized she was past the age of having kids, and Abraham didn't look like he had much time left in him. So she said, well, I have this handmaid that we'd picked up when we were in Egypt the first time. How about you get her pregnant and I'll kind of adopt the child and then we'll help God to fulfill the promise, because obviously he's not doing anything, right? Because he said, but I mean, it's been how many years and he's not coming through, so I'll just step forward and help him out. So Abraham, yeah, sure, sounds good to me, you know. So he listens to his wife and they have Ishmael, which was a huge mistake. And Ishmael causes problems originally, and Sarah wants her gone, and kicks him out, and then they come back, and the Lord has to intervene to make things right. But he says to Abraham all along, you know, Abraham, it's still his son, and he loves the kid and raises up. And then when God says, no, you're going to have a son, he says, oh, yeah, let Ishmael live before you forever. And God says, no. No, because that was you trying to do something in your own strength, and no, that's not what I promised. You know, I'll make sure that he's taken care of, but Sarah's going to have the child. My promise to you is through Sarah. And the interesting thing is, and it tells us pretty plainly in the book of Galatians in the New Testament, that all of this happened to them, but it was also an allegory, that there is some bigger picture kind of stuff going on, that the idea of there's the flesh and the spirit, we'll see. There's the things that you and I try to do in our own strength, and then there's what God would do in his strength. And you and I trying to accomplish things ourselves without God's guidance, outside of his will, is always a bad thing. And what happens is it ends up causing problems. Here you have Ishmael making fun of Isaac. Galatians chapter 4, verse 29, he says, as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the spirit, even so it is now. It goes on in Galatians 5 to say that the flesh, that's you and me, the meat part of us, you and I are, we are a soul that lives in a body and then has a spirit, which is the part of us that connects us to God. We're a little inferior trinity. You are not your body, right? Because you know, I mentioned this morning when I was at the fair taking pictures the other day, I ran across an older man who was a Marine who was missing a leg and he had an artificial limb. He was still him. He was no less him. His container was a little smaller and didn't move quite as fast, but he was still him. And you can be you without parts of your body. That is just the container. But the you is the soul part, the eternal part. But then there is the spiritual part, and that's the part that starts out dead because we're born sinful, and it gets made alive when you're born again. Well, The flesh side of us, which includes our appetites, our carnal desires, the things that we want to do of ourselves, That's contrary. It says the flesh lusts against the spirit, the spiritual side, the stuff that comes from God. And the spirit, it's against the flesh. And those two are contrary one to another. But you can't do the things you would. There's a battle going on. Once you've been saved, once you've accepted God's forgiveness, you become spiritually alive, and then there's a struggle that happens. I wish there was no struggle. I pray for the day when there is no struggle. What I've come to understand is that only happens one of two ways. Either he returns and takes us home, or we die. Other than that, struggle. And that battle going on is a picture of what we see here between the fleshly side, what Abraham did with Isaac, with Ishmael in his own strength, and then Isaac that was the child of promise. Well, when Sarah sees that going on, that struggle between Ishmael and Isaac, she said to Abraham, "Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac." And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son. Because it was his boy, and he didn't want to see him go. He liked Ishmael. I mean, yeah, he made a mistake in having Ishmael, but that doesn't mean he doesn't love Ishmael. And now his wife is saying, "I just had a baby Isaac. He's going to be the heir. That abomination that you did, you need to get him out of here." Well, God says to Abraham, "Let it not be grievous in your sight because of the lad and because of the bondwoman. In all that Sarah has said unto thee, hearken unto her voice, for in Isaac shall your seed be called." God shows up and he says, "Abe, she's right this time, and you should listen to her." Last time he had listened to his wife, which was back in Genesis chapter 16, it was with the whole, "Hey, let's take my handmaiden and you can have a baby with her." He listened to his wife, and God says, "You shouldn't have listened to your wife." This time, she's actually telling him, "You're right. This boy and his mom need to go." So how do you know when to listen to your wife? When she sounds like the Lord, listen to her. When she doesn't, don't. I mean, you know, in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22, you come to the verses that talk about husbands and wives' roles in marriage. And the one that guys always quote, Ephesians 5, 22, "Wives, submit yourself to your husband as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife." And then it talks about the husband loving his wife. But what most people skip over is the verse before that, which says, "Submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of the Lord." That the basis for marriage should be the husband and the wife laying down their own rights in preference of one another. Then, when it comes to the ultimate expression of roles in the marriage, there can be one captain of a ship. Husbands, you are saddled with all of the responsibility. Wives, you need to let him lead, even if he isn't a worthy one. Husbands, you need to love your wife like Christ loved the church, which is to go where she lived, because that's what he did. He came to where we lived and died there. Died to himself, died to his desires, and gave himself completely for her. That's the model. Well, Sarah's right here. You need to cast Ishmael out. And God says, "And also the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation because he's your seed." Abe, you have to trust me on this one. I'm going to take care of him. I understand you love your son. That's natural. It's okay. I'm going to take care of him, but you need to trust me in this. Abraham, this is a good moment for him. It says in verse 14, "Abraham rose up early in the morning." Okay, God says to do it. I'm going to be obedient. "And he took bread and a bottle of water, and he gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder, and the child, he sent her away, and she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba." Now that sounds a little harsh, doesn't it? Because we know Abraham's a wealthy man. If you've been following along in this study so far, he's loaded. He's got a lot of servants, he's got a lot of animals, he's got a lot of whatever. When it's time for his son and wife's handmaid to go, he gives her a little hunk of bread and some water and kicks her out the door. Now, doesn't that seem a little harsh on some level? It's actually obedience. Because God had said in verse 13, "I'm going to take care of the boy." God acknowledged that Abraham loved his son. When you love your son, your desire usually is to provide for them everything they could ever possibly need. But if God was really going to be the provider for Ishmael and Hagar, then Abraham was not going to step in and load all kinds of stuff in there. Because then she'd trust in Abraham's provision until it started to run out. No, God had said go. He's sending her on her way. Now, if this is a picture, remember, of your flesh and your spirit, on some level, it's the right thing to do. If there is a conflict between your fleshly side and what you want to do that you shouldn't do, and your spiritual side, what you should do but maybe don't feel like doing, what's the right thing to do to get rid of the flesh side? I say starve it, because that's what he does here, right? Send it with no provision. It says in Romans chapter 8, therefore, brethren, we're debtors, not to the flesh, to live after the flesh. You don't owe your flesh anything because it has treated you so poorly. All of those desires that makes you want to do the wrong thing, you don't owe it nothing. It has taken advantage of you so many times. Don't feel like you have to baby it. Kick it out the door. He says, because if you live after the flesh, you'll die. But if you, through the Spirit, mortify like rigor mortis, like death, like kill, if you kill the deeds of your body, you'll live. What does that look like? Well, Colossians tells us, and I'm going to read a couple verses from Colossians chapter 3. If you want to go there, you can. I'm just going to read through a few verses. He describes what this looks like to mortify the flesh. He says, if you be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sits on the right hand of God. If you've been born again, if you're risen with Christ, well then, how about you go after the stuff that God is all about? Set your affection on the things above and not on the things of the earth. Don't get so wrapped up in the here and now, in the things that's only temporary, that you forget the stuff that's eternal. He says, for you're dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. You remember, after you believed, you were baptized. Hopefully you've been obedient in that. It doesn't save you, but it's just an outward sign of what happened inside. Baptism is just identifying, yep, just like Jesus died and rose again, I'm going to be dead in him, and I'm coming up out of the water like I'm going to rise again when he takes me home. He says, when Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall you also appear with him in glory. Mortify, therefore, your members which are upon the earth. And this is what that looks like. Fornication, that's all sexual stuff outside of marriage. Uncleanness, inordinate affection, loving stuff that you shouldn't too much. Evil concupiscence. I know you guys are concupiscence and out there. I can hear it. No, concupiscence, it's a King James word. It means desiring the forbidden thing. Uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence. See, all your concupiscence distracted me. Covetousness, which is idolatry. For these things, the wrath of God comes upon the children of disobedience, in the which you also walked some time when you lived in them. But now, he also put off all these. Oh, all these too. Anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication out of your mouth. Lie not one to another, seeing that you've put off the old man, and you've put on the new man, which is renewed in the knowledge after the image of him that created him, where there's neither Greek nor Jew, circumcision, uncircumcision, barbarian, Scythian, bond or free, but Christ is all in all. He says, all of that old stuff that you used to be, you got to take that off. Get rid of it. Get it out of your life. You don't want any of that stuff you used to do before you were saved being part of your life, and put on to replace it, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercy, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering, forbearing one another, putting each other first, and forgiving one another. If anyone has a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do you. And above all these things, put on charity, it means love, which is the bond of perfectness. Let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to the which you're also called in one body. Be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, singing with the grace in your hearts to the Lord. And whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father by him. That's how you put to death the flesh. You stop doing all the old junk you used to do, get it out of your life. You start doing the things that you know God loves and act that way. It's a choice you get to make. See, because that war is there, and the war will continue. And you know, I heard John Corson describe it this way. It's like you have two dogs. A good dog that's white, got white fur, it's a nice dog, and then a bad dog, black dog. You got two dogs. The black dog, he don't like you. He wants to eat you. He wants to eat you. The only thing standing between you and the black dog is the white dog, because he's your friend. So if you got two dogs, and they both, one wants to save you, one wants to eat you, who's going to win? It's the one that you feed. If you feed the black dog and you starve the white dog, don't be surprised when the thing that hates you bites you. But if you feed the thing that is defending you and you starve the thing so that it's weak, see, because there are a lot of people who think, well, I'm a Christian, I can do whatever I want. And they start filling their lives with junk and whatever that junk may be, whether it's stuff you shouldn't listen to, stuff you shouldn't watch, stuff you shouldn't consume, whatever it is, you know, it's between you and God. The stuff that you shouldn't be doing, if you're pouring that into your life, don't be surprised when it bites you. It does. However, if you starve that side, the stuff that you shouldn't do, and you feed the stuff that you should do, which is with godly things, you put in stuff that supports what the Lord says, you hang around with people who actually encourage you in your faith instead of drag you back to what you used to be, you'll find safety. Well, Abraham sends her out, very little provision, trusting her and his son to the Lord. It says, and the water was spent in the bottle, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs, and she went and sat down over against him a good way off, as it were a bow shot. For she said, let me not see the death of the child. And she sat over against him and lifted up her voice and wept. They get out in the wilderness. The wilderness in that part of the country is deserty. And the little provision that Abraham has made is gone. They have nothing to drink. So she takes her son and she puts him under a shade tree, and then she has to get away from him because she knows he's going to die and she can't bear to watch him die. And she's crying. Now, it's interesting to me that God allows her resources to completely run out so that she has to call and cry out to him. See, because she had run into God back in Genesis chapter 16 when Sarah kicked her out the last time. And God had promised her, don't worry, you can go back there. I'm going to take care of you. Your son's going to have a ton of offspring, and he's going to become a great people because he is Abraham's descendant, and I'm going to take care of him. So she had this promise from God a long time ago, but apparently she'd forgotten it because now she thinks her son's going to die. And she's at that place again. It says, God heard the voice of the lad. And the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said unto her, what ails you, woman? What aileth thee, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. What's he saying? Because remember, he's not a little baby here. He's a teenager, a later teen. Apparently dying under the tree, he's praying too. Because remember, all things said and done, and we know that Ishmael becomes the head of the race that can't stand the Jews and there's enmity there forever. But he was still Abraham's son, and he grew up watching dad who trusted God. Is he praying? I don't know. We know that he knew God really, that dad really believed in God, because when he was 13, back in Genesis chapter 17, his dad circumcised him because God said to do it, and then circumcised himself at 99 years old, or whatever it was. So he knew dad was serious about his relationship with God. Whatever the case, God says, I heard the lad. Arise, lift up the lad, hold him in your hand, for I will make of him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went, and she filled the bottle with water, and she gave the lad to drink. She opened her eyes to the provision that had already been provided ahead of time. She didn't see it. She was there. She's miserable. She thinks God has left her. She's in the middle of the desert. She's fearing for her son. She's fearing for herself. She thinks she's been abandoned. And the whole time, the provision of God has already happened, because a well just doesn't dig itself. There was a well there. And it doesn't say that God made a well. It says there was a well, and he opened her eyes so she could see the well. The thing to understand from this story, who was it who told Abraham to cast out Hagar and Ishmael? Well, it was Sarah originally, but then God showed up and said, yes, that's what you're supposed to do. She needs to go. So it was God's plan for her to go where? Into the desert. Because sometimes we get in the desert and we think, God, you hate me, right? You're getting me. And then we go down through the list of all the things that we've done to somebody and try to forgive them or whatever, because we think God's getting us because we're in a dry place. But it's important to realize that sometimes the desert is exactly where you're supposed to be. That he actually wants you there, because you get out there and all your resources dry out and you're forced to cry out to God. Because as long as you got that resource that you got from somebody else, you can cling to that and maybe that'll get you through. I think from time to time, the will of God is to get us to a place where we can only be helped by him. Well, she is. And God shows up because he made promises to her. And he gives her the provision that he'd already provided, opens her eyes. It says God was with the lad. He grew. He dwelt in the wilderness. He became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, northern Saudi Arabia. And his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt, her homeland. She went and found him a wife. And God provided. God gave him what they needed. Now, a couple more verses. We'll go through it quick. It came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, spoke unto Abraham, saying, God's with you and all that you do. Because he knows Abe's a prophet, right? God had told him that in a dream. He knows that he was healed when Abraham prayed for him. He saw Sodom and Gomorrah. He's from that area, so he knows what God did there. And now he sees that Abraham at 100 years old with a 90-year-old wife just had a baby. So Abimelech takes a look at Abraham and says, dude, there's one thing I can tell you. God must like you because you got stuff going on. And because of that, look what he does. He says, now therefore swear unto me here by God that you won't deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor with my son's son, but according to the kindness that I've done unto you, you shall do to me in the land wherein you've sojourned. He's a king, big kingdom. Abraham's a shepherd. He's got a few hundred guys that follow him, but king, shepherd. The king comes to Abraham and says, I can tell God's with you. I want you to do me a favor. Promise that you guys will always be nice to me and my kids and my grandkids, because I understand that God's with you and I don't want you as my enemy. So he's actually coming as a king to make peace treaty with some guy who doesn't even settle down. He lives in a tent. And Abraham says, yeah, I'll swear. But since you're scared of me, there's one thing we should talk about. Abraham reproved Abimelech because of a well of water, which Abimelech's servants had violently taken away. He says, okay, well, I'll make a deal with you. But you know, there was this well that I dug, and then some of your boys showed up and took it. And Abimelech says, I wot not who's done this thing. I didn't, and neither did you tell me. I just heard of it now, just but today. I heard of it. Abraham took sheep and oxen, gave them to Abimelech. Both of them made a covenant. Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. So they traded some stuff. And then he took 7 female lambs and he put them off to the side. And Abimelech said to Abraham, what's the point of those? What mean these 7 ewe lambs which you've set by themselves? And he said, for these 7 ewe lambs that you shall take of my hand, that they may be a witness unto me that I have digged this well. They're going to remind you. Every time you look at those 7 lambs, you're going to remember that this is my well. All right? The ones that you took and said you didn't know anything about, let me give you something to remind you. Here's 7 lambs. Wherefore, he called that place Beersheba, which means the well of oath or of swearing, because there they swear, both of them. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, and they returned to the land of the Philistines. And Abraham planted a grove of trees in Beersheba. It's literally tamarisk trees. And he called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham sojourned in the Philistines' land many days. This is a new name for Abraham. He's like having this progressive revelation of who God is. And at different times he learns new names of God. This one, the everlasting God, it actually means beyond the vanishing point. You know how it is when you're driving on a long straightaway and you can see the road kind of narrow down and then eventually it gets to the place where you just can't see any further? Abraham's 100 years old. He's got a little baby, 100 years old. When you're 100 years old and you got a little baby and you've got the prospect of kids, grandkids, you realize that, you know, 100 years old, I'm not a spring chicken anymore. I got limited time. I need a God who's going to be around for my kids, for my grandkids, and that goes beyond me. And he in this place, he has a new perspective on who God is. You know, my prayer is, one, that we would be like Abraham and that people would see the way God works in our life and say, I don't know what it is, but I know that your God is real and there's a difference about you. I pray that they say, I want what you got. That's my prayer. And I don't know if you're one of those people who is in the dry place right now, you're in a desert. Could just be that God's trying to get your attention and get you out of your own resources so that you can call out to him and see him move on your behalf. He made promises. You know, there are general promises he made in the scripture. If you pray and seek him and read his word, I would say he'll speak to you and that some of these things you'll read will become promises that you can lay hold of. Whenever that happens, guaranteed he will answer whatever he's promised to do. If you're struggling, if you need prayer, come up. I'd be glad to pray with you. Let's pray now. God, thank you so much, Lord, that you put up with people like Abraham and people like me. Lord, that you are graceful, that even when we're stupid, you're willing to still be associated with us. Lord, you allow us to be called Christians, little Christs, when we don't follow you always the way we should. Lord, let those times be few. And Lord, help us to be men and women after your heart. Lord, help us to starve the things in our life that draw us away from you. And Lord, please, come back quick. We long for the day when we don't have to have this fight anymore. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Grace and peace, guys.